Welcome to the Passport Play Podcast with Jonathan Lord. This episode's guest, Iago Colas, is a professor at the University of Michigan and the author of Ball Don't Lie, Myth, Genealogy, and Invention in the Cultures of Basketball. Let's get started right away with the course you teach at the University of Michigan. And I got to tell you, I don't ever remember sitting in on a lecture where I got to watch 5 minutes of Michael Jordan highlights. Can you tell me exactly how you get away with doing that with your students?
Get away with it from what point of view? You mean from the point of view of the college?
Yeah, you know, I ask semi-seriously because aren't we supposed to be all about rigor and discipline and academia? And gosh, if there were some class that were introduced as, hey, let's learn about culture through Michael Jordan highlights, I sure would have signed up for that one.
Right. Well, you know, I think that it's the class is just one of several that I teach at Michigan that have different aspects of sports culture as a content. But the content is there partly just as a gateway to other things that are, I think, more conventionally understood to be parts of, you know, an academic curriculum. So in the case of the Cultures of Basketball class, when I first pitched it, my argument was that as a form of popular culture, basketball is obviously popular, but more importantly, is a kind of lens through which we can take a look at issues in American history, such as race or gender, big business, the entertainment industry, and so forth. So that's really not a kind of hard pitch to make. It's part of, I think it's a common one that people like myself who work in the field of sports studies make. It's part of what drew us to the field in the first place. And I certainly haven't had any serious kind of issues with college administrators or colleagues in response to these courses. They recognize that it's an established academic field, and they see that it can be a valuable way to engage students and lead them into discussions of issues that they might have a harder time getting access to otherwise. So occasionally, you know, there are people who aren't too informed about what I'm doing, haven't seen a syllabus, for example, and so they get a little concerned that it's, you know, a kind of not a real course or something like that. But most of those people, as soon as I explain what I'm doing or share a syllabus, feel completely reassured. They understand. They just didn't know it was a thing.
Well, I think for so many people, there's this stigma attached to sports and sports discourse, which doesn't need to exist, but has for so long. And I love what you said earlier about there being a lens. And for so many young people, they need to be introduced to important issues and topics through something that they can relate to. And sports is something that is relatable to so many different people that you're able to really use it as a way to get people interested in issues that really do matter in this country and the world.
Yeah, exactly so. And it can go in a lot of different directions depending on student interests. You know, some students are more kind of philosophically inclined, and basketball and other sports present lots of interesting issues for philosophical discussion or historical or social or what have you. So it's a very flexible kind of entry point as well that can really take people in a lot of different directions and respond to their particular interests and get them to think not only about those issues in those fields, but to think about an activity, sports, that they really love more deeply and a little more critically so that they can understand there's kind of more to it than just, you know, turning on the TV or showing up at the arena and cheering on their favorite team or player.
You were, in your book, you write a lot about, I think it's in the introduction, you write a lot about how before this was a book, it was a course. And I love that line, and I love how you recite it over and over again. And it makes me think, though, how much of the pages that we uncover in your book are actual almost lessons from your course.
Yeah, it turned out that way. I mean, the course I first taught in the winter semester of 2011, that was 5 years ago, And I was very new to the field at that time. I just knew I kind of had a passion for it and that I had thought about basketball in more complex ways kind of all my life. But I wasn't at that point all that familiar with other scholarship in the field. And so the course has evolved in the times I've taught it since then. And kind of now takes this form where I do use the book as a basis for organizing the course, and students read from the book as well as other materials and watch some documentaries and stuff. But yeah, it's turned out to be something like that, a real kind of marriage of teaching and research and also other interactions with people, you know, online, because, you know, there's a lot of, I don't know if I'd say maybe necessarily, well, mainstream, yes, but also just a little bit maybe on the margins of mainstream, smart writers about sports out there that I think people don't realize because, you know, so much of it is just maybe headlines or recaps and that kind of thing. But there's also a non-academic, intellectual and thoughtful community of writers out there, as you know. So they've taught me a lot as well. It's really been a very fruitful kind of intersection of a lot of different strands of thought.
And when I used to teach, I was a high school history teacher for 10 years. And when I used to teach, I remember that some of the best lessons, the best plans that I ever came up with came from the students themselves. And you know, you go in thinking that you're going to present this wonderful lesson that is researched, that you've collaborated on with other, you know, like-minded teachers, and you have the experience and the wherewithal to convey these points accurately and convincingly. And then you get into class and the students have these minds that are, you know, so open that they introduce new angles and avenues to stories which you hadn't thought about before. And so it must be really, as a professor, it must be very reinvigorating to be surrounded by so many young people and open-minded people.
Absolutely. It is. I have found it to be that way. And it's also that I think you're right. I mean, they have minds that in many ways are more open and more flexible, but they also have their own experiences of this kind of thing. I mean, you mentioned history. You know, they all are living history in some way. And whether or not they're able to articulate exactly how their particular histories connect to the broad kinds of histories you might have been teaching them about, they do have an experience of these things, and they can really inform those discussions. And even more importantly, maybe, I feel that they can, how to put it, it's another way for them to engage when they realize that it belongs to them as well, history, I mean. And the same is true, of course, with sports. I mean, I do get occasionally students in class who are curious and haven't really been very involved or engaged by sports in the past, and they want to kind of know more of what it's about, and they've got interesting perspectives from kind of the outside. But most students have been lifelong sports fans, some are athletes, and so those experiences are a really valuable contribution to the discussion, even as I also sometimes try to expand their horizons so that they can see what they know from their experience isn't necessarily the end of the discussion, right?
Yeah, and switching hats for a second, as not just an academic but as a fan, that must be infuriating at times, because every generation has their favorites and their idols, and nothing is as good as the people that they grew up with. And so when you're hearing about all these young kids and let's say the basketball players of today, how there's never been as good a player as, well, you know, you name them, you know, a LeBron James or a Steph Curry or a Kobe Bryant. And then you yourself and me, we, you know, coming from growing up during different eras, we would shake our head and say, you know, no, you have to compare, or it's impossible to compare. And in fact, you do write about this in your book. I think it's about the Michael Jordan and how the greatest of all time, and how it's really, I don't know if you settle on it's impossible to quantify, but it, in a way it is impossible to quantify and say this is the greatest of all time. We all have our opinions, right?
Yeah, I mean, I think there are ways to introduce quantitative reasoning in order to inform these comparisons, but I don't think that quantitative reasoning is necessarily the only or the best way to do so. I think other kinds of considerations need to be taken into account, many of which are personal, And these kinds of, you know, cross-historical comparisons, again, they're a great example of how you can turn something that just seems to be more or less a kind of barroom debate among sports fans into a way to reflect on the nature of history and how the past is different from the present, even as it is connected to the present. And, you know, that's a deeper lesson there that goes well beyond sports.
Yeah, well, let's start there and get into your book. And you did talk a lot about Michael Jordan, and not just as, you know, the greatest player of all time, but this idea, you know, we can get into this later, but your book is broken down into chapters, all these different myths. And yeah. the myth on Jordan was part of this section on the myth of the basketball empire. And Jordan became not just this player, but also this global product during this age of consumerism. Right. You know, maybe that's the indelible mark of a Michael Jordan. It's not just his greatness as an athlete, but it's his greatness as a marketable commodity.
Right, and I think that's exactly so. And I think it's part of what I try to show in that chapter in particular is the ways in which the opinions we form about players, you know, ostensibly, we feel just, you know, that they may be based just on what we are watching them do on the court, have already been suddenly informed by all kinds of other aspects of culture, whether it be marketing or consumption or media or cultural narratives, or even in the case of that chapter, what's going on in global politics. You know, and these connections are not necessarily explicit or obvious, and the ways that they work on us are not necessarily conscious in our minds. Sometimes these things work unconsciously, but all of those things go into shaping and creating this kind of consensus, in my opinion, that Jordan was the greatest of all time. It doesn't mean he's not a great player. It doesn't mean he might not be the greatest player of all time, but if nothing else, at least getting back to the specifics of that chapter, what really struck me was that since all time is not over yet, and as far as I know, never will be, it seems like an odd way to kind of formulate the judgment. I think a more appropriate statement would be the greatest player I've ever seen, or my favorite player ever. Or, you know, potentially even there could be a consensus that, you know, he is the greatest player so far. I could even understand that statement, but the all-time thing is one of those kind of like tells, like in card playing, where something is sort of being revealed because of the way in which it's being stated, right? And I go back to my original training as a professor of literature, and so my expertise lies in studying language and the ways in which we put it together, and oftentimes say more than what we might mean in the way that we use language. So I'm looking for things like that, and that's the case with Jordan, in my opinion, that it's a little bit over, there's an overstatement involved that I think suggests we need to look more deeply as to why we believe the thing we believe.
And I wonder how much of that you would say is due to the media, mainstream media and coverage of the sport. And, you know, as a fan, so much of what we infer about an athlete comes from the general perception of that athlete and the marketing of that athlete. And that's really able to shape the popularity, but also our memory of someone like a Michael Jordan, right? I mean, the brand still exists today in part because not just he was a great player, but in part because his persona was magnified by economic markets, by mainstream media. And so now today we're left with these vivid memories that we hold on a pedestal that don't quite compare to the modern day or the present day players like, say, you know, a LeBron James. And you have a whole chapter on LeBron James called The Myth of the Man. And it is so fascinating to me to read that and think how much of what we think we know about LeBron James and his decision to leave Cleveland the first time comes from the way the story was covered by the media, comes from the way we, you know, view race and identify race as you know, a way of evaluating basketball players and athletes in general. It just raises so many issues. But the idea of the media controlling our opinions is one that I'm interested in hearing you on.
Yeah, I think, I mean, the media, of course, shapes our opinions in really strong ways. These players, as you pointed out, are not accessible to most of us on a personal basis, so that we really can't, I can't at least say that I know them as people. And so, you know, the media mediates between them and us. I think at the time of Jordan, there was a particular thing that kind of intensified that phenomenon, in that there really had not been a player who was covered so extensively, who was such a media phenomenon. So there's also a kind of, I think, issue at work there that's not in play to the same degree today, which is that we weren't used to it. And so it's kind of like a kid sort of stepping into the ocean for the first time. They don't really know what the force of that wave is going to do to them, and they're going to get knocked off their feet. And I think in certain comparable ways, our abilities to think critically were sort of disabled by the excitement generated by Jordan's play, for sure, but also by the enthusiasm for Jordan's play in the media. And as you say, by all the kind of marketing apparatus that sprang up at that time, really for the first time in basketball history, around Jordan. And when I think about media and marketing, partly what I think about is the ways in which they really explicitly are geared to try to identify and tap into and sort of prime our desires, oftentimes deep desires for certain kinds of things, for being certain kinds of people, for possessing certain kinds of objects, for getting closer to certain kinds of individuals. And those desires are really powerful. I mean, they are a way in which we compensate for other things that may be missing in our lives, or express a desire for our lives to be something a bit more than what they might be. And when you put all that together, I don't know if I'd say control exactly, that the media controls our opinions, but they really have a strong influence on us, and partly because they appear so innocuous and to simply be delivering information. And in the case of basketball, information on a relatively trivial seeming topic that we don't necessarily take the time to think more carefully about. So we just kind of eat it up.
Would you say that these are similar factors that have led to the presentation of a Steph Curry as an incredibly popular figure in basketball today? I mean, beyond just his magnetic skill and his ability on the court that, you know, I think we can say we haven't seen in a while. But the presentation of Steph Curry, I think you would argue, is palatable to a wide range of consumers today.
Yes, absolutely. Sometimes with my students, to kind of get this point across, I try to offer them a way of thinking about it in which I say, you know, I'm not talking about Steph Curry. I'm talking about Steph Curry in quotes. To distinguish between the human being, whom I do not know, the player, who I can see is an incredibly skilled basketball player, certainly one of the most talented and exciting I have seen, and the guy who's in quote marks, which is Steph Curry, the product and the object of media discussion, which is the thing that I'm really looking at least when I'm looking critically. So yes, I see definitely that there are aspects to the way in which quote-unquote Steph Curry has been presented to us that are designed to emphasize certain qualities that will be broadly appealing to more people. Sometimes I think at the expense of other players who, for different reasons, are not presented in the same kind of light. And I think that goes back to a long kind of tension in the culture of basketball that has to do with money and society, which is that most basketball players are black and most basketball fans are white. And so they have been trying ever since really the late 50s, early 60s, with the advent of the first black stars, to find ways to market a primarily black product to a primarily white audience. And the principal means that they discovered to do so was to pr- present players, and in a certain sense select for players among the great players, to select for those who are least threatening, who are easiest to shift away from the kinds of conventional stereotypes that many white Americans have about black Americans, that cause them to feel kind of suspicious, wary, alienated, or what have you. And so Steph, as a relatively light-skinned player, as a family man, both in terms of his family of origin, with a two-parent family, with his daughter, there's a lot of ways in which Steph can present a non-threatening, appealing persona or product for the NBA right now. And as you said, and I always feel like I have to emphasize this because outside of my classroom, I don't have as much control over how people take what I say. It is not to say that he is not a fantastic player or that he does not deserve the attention and respect and esteem that he has enjoyed as a player. That just doesn't have anything to do with it. In fact, if anything, if I may go back to the Jordan chapter for a second, sometimes I feel that these kind of adulatory narratives that we create around these players, like that Jordan's the greatest of all time, or that Steph is now, maybe needs to be in that conversation, part of the damage I think they do is that they cause us to stop seeing and appreciating the talent and the artistry and the variety of kind of forms of beauty and excellence that these athletes are exhibiting on the court. Their narratives that tend to impoverish our abilities to perceive what's right in front of us.
It's not just fans of the game that you know, you're talking about race and identifying players, you know, as one race or you know, fan bases coming from one race. But you also talk a lot in your book about how the foundation of the sport, the creation of the sport, was based in this this discourse about race and about how about how the game was created to suit this idyllic vision of kind of almost like a white middle class man, and how there was a way to play the game that ran in accordance with those values, and then if you didn't play the game that way, then you weren't playing the game the right way. But what you were basically saying is that you weren't white enough, and I'm wondering if that idea, I mean, we're talking about the beginnings of the sport of basketball, but I'm wondering if that idea is still pervasive in the game today. My sense is that you think it still exists.
Oh yeah, I think there's no question that it still exists. At least not in my mind. I think that those notions, the way that I think about it is that from very early on, from the beginnings, in subtle ways, basketball discourse or culture involves a kind of superimposition or tying together of tactical recommendations, racial preferences, and a particular moral code. And that all kind of comes together in the idea of playing the right way. And I think, you know, playing the right way is a phrase that any basketball fan is familiar with. It's certainly something that tactically is not without meaning in specific situations. In other words, given your personnel, there are better and worse ways to play, depending on who you've got on your team. And, you know, overall, there are certain aspects of basketball play that are more likely to lead to success on the court. Once again, depending on who you've got on your team. But it's a long way, a big step from recognizing that there are better and worse ways to play, to saying that there is a right way to play. And then when that is invoked as a kind of norm, what you start to see is that the sort of interpretive culture of the game spits out negative judgments of styles of play and of individual players that seem to deviate from that norm. And that carries with it a kind of moral force and oftentimes plays out or skews racially. So, you know, going back to, let's say, the appearance of Wilt Chamberlain, and you've got this kind of offensive force who is pretty much unstoppable, and whose weapon, one of whose weapons, is the slam dunk. And people at the time, for example, writer John McPhee, an American writer, at the time felt that the game was kind of being destroyed, which meant the game, as he had grown familiar with it, was being destroyed. And instead of Chamberlain, who he thought was kind of too big and too single-focused as a player, he went with Bill Bradley as his kind of optimum basketball player. Larry Brown is another kind of example of this, I mean, in the sense that he is the coach who really kind of made this mantra famous. So, yeah, and you see it today. I think people love the Spurs and the Warriors because when they see them play, they see a lot of ball movement. They see everybody seems to be involved, a lot of movement without the ball. They see balanced teams, they feel. And I think that's fine. I think that's true of those teams. But I also think it's true of other teams that I often find wind up getting compared negatively to those clubs, as though they're not playing the right way. They're doing something kind of morally wrong or aesthetically distasteful. And, you know, I think LeBron's Cavs teams are good examples of that, right? I mean, when I see the Cavs, I see when they've got players on the floor, a lot of movement. I mean, I guess I'm saying I don't think there's any good basketball player who doesn't recognize that involving teammates and moving the ball and moving without the ball and getting good shots isn't the best way to play. They all recognize that. They're elite basketball players. They're professionals. They know. But they don't always have those people on the floor, or the circumstances of the game don't dictate that. So last year in the finals, we saw LeBron doing a lot of isolation. Some people at least felt that, you know, look at that. Like, that's why, you know, he can't be, you know, a Jordan, because he doesn't understand this. And I don't think that's true. It's simply false.
But what you're also saying, which is very interesting to me, is that a lot of our vision of the way games, basketball is played properly, you know, you mentioned things like unselfishness and cooperation,
yes,
and hard work.
Thank you.
That these are not just the embodiments and the values of good basketball, that these were also back in the day the self-identifying characteristics of white middle class men. And
yes,
and that when you deviate from those ways of playing, of behaving, in a way it is I don't want to say it's betraying race, but it is in a way it's racially identifying people. It's a way of saying that a person plays more white or they play more black, and it certainly contributes to the way we watch the game.
Yeah, the moral values that were encoded into the invention of the game, the things that Naismith wanted his players to develop, morally speaking, came to be seen as kind of universal and timeless qualities that really everyone should aspire to, regardless of circumstances, on the court or off the court. And so to the degree that people didn't adhere to those codes, they were perceived to be morally deficient. So yeah, I mean, it was a thing, I mean, a simple fact that I find at least many of my students didn't know about until I introduced it to them, is that the game was devised as an instrument of moral improvement. And it so happened that the morals that Naismith and others at the time sought to inculcate were the morals of their race and class in America at that time, and religion for that matter. And that's fine. I mean, I don't fault Naismith for that. I fault those who subsequently kind of absorbed that and did so in an uncritical and unflexible way that didn't recognize that different circumstances in life and on the court dictate different moral evaluations, moral decisions, and tactical decisions. And a lot of that has to do with the diversity of this country and with social injustice in this country.
And you know, by the way, you don't just see this in basketball. You know, I'm a baseball fan, and I can tell you that so much about how we view baseball and baseball players is rooted in these similar questions and things about race and how there's a right way to play the game. And you talk about the way we as baseball fans in this country, you know, watch guys like let's say Yasiel Puig or Jose Bautista. You know, we watch the way that some of the Latin players play the game, you know, with the bat flips and other things which fans don't think are indicative of the true spirit of the game of baseball, which is rooted in a lot of social hierarchies which have been existing in this country for an awful long time.
Yes, absolutely. You know, and I don't consider myself to be an expert really in other sports histories to this degree, but one of the things that's been gratifying to hear from readers is that they feel that a lot of what I'm setting up at the general level in the book, they find applicable to other sports, that other sports have their myths in the same way, and that those myths work in similar ways to kind of exert a constraining normative sort of force on these athletes, from which some athletes wind up suffering in popular opinion.
When LeBron James made his decision to leave Cleveland, that a lot of fans had an issue with that decision, not because of the idea that it didn't make basketball sense, but because of the way he did it and because of the way he conspired with other black basketball players, athletes, to kind of group together and form these super teams. And that rankled a lot of people the wrong way in this country.
Yes, it sure did. Right. I think there's a lot in that moment to look at. I'm not sure quite where to begin, but, you know, let's talk about the conspiring with other players to form a super team. It seems that, I mean, judging from the way people reacted to that, that the issue is the underlying belief is that only owners have the right to form super teams. The Heat, with LeBron and Bosch and Wade, were not the first super team, as you know. If by super team we mean a team with two or three superstars, you know, the Celtics had formed one just a few years before. The Lakers had one for, you know, around the turn of the century. The Lakers and Celtics had one in the 80s. The Bulls had one in the 90s. Owners are always trying to do this, as they should, because that's how, you know, you get dynasties going. I think that, you know, LeBron's crime in that regard was that he appropriated that power for himself along with his teammates. And so there you got to think about it, in my view anyway, the ways in which we as Americans view business and industry and work and ownership, and that in some ways, you know, LeBron violated some deep code that we have in American society regarding hierarchies in the workplace, and that as workers, you know, we are supposed to do our jobs and specialize in whatever it is we do, and that the people who are supposed to make the big decisions are those who own things. That's a problematic belief, in my view. There are other elements of the decision. There is, of course, the television broadcast. There is the run-up to the decision and how he handled his meetings with different teams that were trying to secure his services. There's the big kind of, you know, party in Miami after the signing. Those things I can understand might rub people the wrong way. But I also feel that the reaction was so intense and so vitriolic, and also so racially skewed, so that we know that white Americans were far more disapproving of LeBron in that circumstance than black Americans. You know, that I think we see other issues at work here. It's not as simple as, you know, LeBron shouldn't have left Cleveland or LeBron should not have made that televised broadcast. We need to look more deeply at ourselves and why it is we feel so strongly about it and entitled to make judgments about those decisions. And in my view, there are these other forces at work. I think that the ones I just said, basically, I think that around the workplace and around race as well. Absolutely. I hate to be so kind of blunt about it, but I feel that it's not. It can't come as a surprise to anybody who pays attention in America that if a young, originally poor black man asserts his right to determine his own future, that's going to be alarming to a certain mentality.
And it was, and not because it threatened the competitive basketball balance. I mean, who really cares about that? But because on some deeper level, this was a group of financially, upwardly, social, mobile black men coming together, making a business and a competitive decision for themselves, and that threatens the existing paradigm in white America. I mean, it is clearly that is much of what bothered people about LeBron James's decision to leave Miami. I mean, because when you get right down to it, who really cares deep down that the Miami Heat formed a super team? I mean, does that really all? Can we not understand why he did that? I mean, all of us.
Yeah, exactly. We would all want to do that. I mean, we were just having this discussion in my class a week or two ago, and I was saying, so, you know, kids, imagine that, you know, you're working for a company, you graduate, you're working for a company, and, you know, you're really good at what you do, but, you know, the company, your coworkers are really not optimal to getting the job done and to helping the company kind of get ahead. So you start looking around for other jobs when your contract is up. Now imagine that everybody's got an opinion about that and is telling you that, no, you should not move to this other company where there are, you know, a group of coworkers who you know are going to bring out the best in you and kind of take you to the next level. Does that seem okay to you? And of course it doesn't, because it's not. It's to me, it's a real clear-cut case. Other details of it, you know, that he did the TV broadcast, I mean, honestly, who cares? You know, Americans in the limelight are constantly making decisions that, you know, may feel excessive to us. At that point, I have to ask my students, let's say, how do you think LeBron wound up the person who at the age of whatever he was at the time, 25 or something, felt that that was the best way to convey this decision? In other words, we created this phenomenon. It is our own desire for LeBron in the first place, and our own need for someone like LeBron that shapes the personality of someone like LeBron and the public decisions that he makes. So, you know, I can understand that broadcast felt to people like a kind of megalomaniacal sort of narcissistic exhibition. But I also think that, let's say, the qualities of LeBron James, as I would guess he has them, which is a high degree of self-confidence and you know, healthy self-esteem and so forth, those are the same things that make him the great basketball player that we wanted to watch all those years. So it's peculiar to me that at that moment we should suddenly police the way in which that gets expressed.
And you're talking about, you know, self-determination and the idea that in this country, you know, we have the opportunity to carve our own path, to work, you know, where we want, when we want, how we want. And you're in a unique position to kind of talk a little bit about this, because as a college professor, you've undoubtedly have students in your class who are athletes at the University of Michigan who perhaps have been, you know, facing issues about, you know, pay for play, you know, things of that nature that I'm sure you have opinions on.
Yeah, I do. I mean, I occasionally encounter that for sure. I mean, I definitely have athletes in my class, and we do talk about those issues in college sports. You know, I mean, the bottom line, I feel like the most, I guess at the deepest level, they are my students. They're young people who are in this process of transition, trying to kind of form themselves as integrated adults during their 4 years of college. And, you know, the central message I want to give them is that the life that they are living is theirs and theirs alone, that they are going to have to live with the choices that they make in the present. Not their coaches, not me, not their parents, not administrators at the university. And also that they have the power to make those choices. So a power and a responsibility, as cliched as that sounds, is theirs. And they need to, the sooner they can recognize that and filter their decisions through that, the better for them in the long run. Now, in terms of the kind of broader issues around college athletics, I mean, the thing that I see at Michigan is, I think, what many people who are now looking at college sports see, which is that you have a sector of the entertainment industry that generates massive revenues and that is professionalized in every other way other than with respect to the students who are generating the revenues through their performance. So I don't feel that the collegiate model, as it's called, or the amateur ideal at the Division I level, which is what I encounter most frequently, is kind of morally defensible. It doesn't make sense to me. So I think that something needs to change in that regard, and you know, there's a lot of different views of how that could change. My own feeling is that the surplus revenues should be distributed among the athletes in a kind of equitable way. So I sometimes imagine, you know, not a kind of free market free-for-all in which, you know, the star quarterback is making an income directly in proportion to the revenues he may generate, whereas the women's lacrosse player who's not generating revenues is not getting anything. I imagine something that would be, you know, I guess more communitarian in a sense, a big pot distributed in some proportions, not necessarily evenly across all sports, but more or less evenly with respect to the effort and time that students are devoting to these activities, which, you know, we know is far in excess of the 20 hours per week that the NCAA stipulates as a limit for their in-season athletic activities.
This is a lot of money we're talking about distributing equitably and fairly. It seems like when you get a lot of people around this kind of money, it would never work that well. You know, talking about divvying it up fairly, that would be the concern I would have.
In what way it would not work well?
Well, look, when you start now, let's say the dispersal of all of these revenues, figuring out a system that is equitable will have initially a lot of challenges because people are going to want as much as they can get their hands on. And that would present a list of factors that I think at first would be hard to overcome. At first.
Yeah, I think it would be hard to overcome. I wouldn't dispute that. But I think that, you know, we as a society have succeeded in meeting many challenges that we've considered to be important that are far more complex. For example, sending a satellite out of a solar system or getting to the moon. We decided those things are important, and we found a way to accomplish them. So I think that, you know, if this was considered important, then we could solve it. And I think, going back to some of our earlier themes, one of the reasons it's, you know, not really considered that important at an unconscious level is because, you know, 53% of the athletes on revenue-generating teams in the FBS are African-American. So, you know, if those were the sons of wealthy white Americans, I think we'd have a different conversation about this.
Let's Let's maybe first get somebody back to the moon before we first before we try to restructure the NCAA. I think that's what you're saying.
No. I'm saying the opposite.
Okay.
We've had somebody on the moon. If you ask me, it's even more important to deal fairly with these young people and solve that problem. I mean, I think there are also other things in between sending someone to the moon and solving the NCAA issues that are even more pressing.
Yeah, I think more pressing. I think if you were to poll the average American, they too would agree that they would like to see some sort of issues resolved in sports before they would the reversal of climate change. I don't know what that says about...
Right. No, I agree. Climate change, you know, of course, there are more important issues. Don't get me wrong.
No.
I'm on record suggesting that it's not. But this is not an unimportant issue.
No, it's not.
And it's, you know, the payment thing is just one side of it. You know, another side that I see firsthand that that really disturbs me is the way in which athletes in any sport tend to get stigmatized on campus as though they don't really belong there, as though they aren't actual students, as though they don't have minds that they are trying to cultivate. You know, we have, I think, around 900 athletes at the University of Michigan. A tiny fraction, I mean, a really tiny fraction will ever make a dime playing their sport. And only a small, slightly larger fraction believe that they're going to make a dime playing their sport. They like to play their sport. They like to win. They like to excel. And they're grateful for the opportunity to try and get an education. And I think that, you know, since an education is what ostensibly we promise them in exchange for their performance, we could do a much better job of making good on that promise. And that's, you know, before you even get to issues of money.
Let's switch gears and talk
sure.
about the title of the book. The title of the book I love and I recognized instantly, and any basketball fan can tell you exactly that moment and where it came from. And the idea of, you know, Rasheed Wallace being he's not the originator of the saying, certainly, but he certainly brought it into mainstream collective consciousness.
Yeah.
And the idea of ball don't lie. Can you just describe how, you know, you talked about how ball don't lie is representative of much more than just simply disagreeing with a foul call, that it's representative of something that is much, much deeper with the game of basketball.
Yes. You know this, of course, but your listeners may not, that the phrase originates on playgrounds and initially on urban playgrounds where black men would be playing basketball recreationally. And it is a way to settle disputes over calls, right? You might argue the call, but at a certain moment, you're not getting anywhere, so you shoot for it. And if your claim is upheld by the shot going in, or not, as the case may be, ball don't lie is what you might say then, to indicate that you were right. And so for me, Rashid's, importation and amplification of that little piece of language and that piece of playground culture into the NBA is expressive, whether or not he intends it this way, is expressive. It serves as a kind of reminder of the autonomy of basketball players, of their ability to manage themselves and their interactions on the court and in life, a kind of check, I guess, on the league and fans and the media's assumptions that that's not the case, that players need to be managed and controlled lest chaos ensue. So, yeah, there's a lot in that phrase to me, and it goes all the way back, in a way, to the invention of the sport, because Naismith's original challenge was to get a class of unruly students under control by finding an entertaining game for them to play. So there's, And in the early days of the sport, it's very funny. I mean, you see administrators of the sport writing articles worried about how to control basketball players, that, you know, they are always on the edge of chaos. And that, as you kind of move forward through the 20th century and the history of the game, once again starts to take on kind of racial and class connotations, where you've got African-American men, oftentimes from disadvantaged economic backgrounds, and this sense that for their own good and for the good of the game, certain decisions about their own lives need to be made by others. You know, that's, to me, about control and power and hierarchies. And I think that, you know, in a really humorous, challenging, interesting way, Rashid is throwing that out and saying, no, we can do this. We've been doing it all along.
What I like about it most of all is that it represents a wonderful belief in self.
Exactly. That's a perfect way to put what I was trying to say in too many words.
Yeah. No, it's well, you're a professor. That's your job. What I mean by that is that I can't go on a pickup basketball court and say, ball don't lie because I'm white. I can't go out on a basketball court and say ball don't lie because I don't believe in my basketball ability. And what, to me, I love about what Rashid said and what other players do when they you know, have, you know, is such self-confidence in their abilities. And I think because for, as fans, it represents a version of ourselves that we were afraid to perhaps work hard enough to become. And living our lives as fans vicariously through these athletes, it's kind of... It's enjoyable.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. It is. And it is a very, I mean, to me, it's inspiring. I mean, that, you know, even as a form, as it's a very mild form, but as a mild form of trash talk, I think it's fantastic and inspiring to me, and something I try to do it on the court, and I don't have the ability to do it, but it's still meaningful to me, and it kind of... cultivates a self-confidence and self-belief, as you said, that I can carry with me in other settings as well. And I think that's part of the meaning of it too. It's not just confidence in their abilities as basketball players, it's confident in themselves as worthy human beings capable of making autonomous decisions about their lives. And that's something I think we all want to experience and to have in our lives and whatever our domains may be. And something we often don't allow ourselves. And I think sometimes we then, you know, some people like you, you know, feel inspired by that and love it. Other people feel resentful that they feel deauthorized to have that kind of confidence in their lives. And I feel sad about that. I don't think that that's good. I wouldn't wish that on anybody. But I don't think that the solution to that feeling is to thereby try to restrict or diminish the expressions of confidence that others have.
I don't know. I don't know if I would argue that this confidence is not exactly transferable to other walks of life. I mean, I don't know if you've done this, but I certainly, as a writer and former teacher, I can't recall looking at a student or looking at a colleague of mine and saying, hey, that paragraph don't lie. It just doesn't necessarily have the same ring to it that it does on the basketball court.
I'm talking about the underlying feeling.
Yeah, gotcha.
of confidence in your capacity.
Yes.
That is what I think transfers. No, the language itself is very unique, I think, to the basketball court. Although, as part of this language, I mean, trash talk on the court itself came second after different forms of sort of signifying discourse in black communities. So, The fact is it originated off the court and then moved on to the court. So there is a certain kind of back and forth that may be available, although I agree it's not always applicable.
Yeah.
But, you know, swagger is swagger, and you can have it anywhere. It may take different forms in different settings, and that's perfectly appropriate, of course. But it's something I would think, you know, anybody would want to be able to feel what that feeling is that leads to it.
Yeah, well, you know what's funny is as you're describing the kind of the self-confidence it takes to talk this way, it makes me want to play pickup basketball more and more because, you know, we all need outlets in our lives. And one of the things that, you know, sports does for us is that it creates an outlet where we can behave in a certain way that makes it easier for us to return to, I guess, society. And that outlet is so crucial. And it's fun to watch these players behaving that way because, you know, I don't want to say they're acting outside of the conforms of society, but there are different rules that apply to them, and that's refreshing.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, that sense of outlet, but of an outlet that gives you something that you then take into your life when you stop the pickup game, you know, that is absolutely in line with what Naismith was doing in designing the game. He was designing a sport that he felt through a kind of embodied action would provide players with a set of feelings and thoughts that they would carry with them off the court. I mean, it's the, you know, the oldest cliche in sports is that it builds character. And my only issue with that is that our definition of what constitutes character is too narrow. And limiting and exclusive, that it reflects a very particular race and class's notion of character. But sports do build character, and those kinds of activities in all their forms, you know, can be transferred. They communicate themselves beyond the court.
Quick last question. Give us a syllabus. Sure. to read, to look at while we're enjoying these NBA playoffs. You talked earlier about how there are a lot of prolific writers that contribute to the basketball discourse, cultural discourse today. Give us a few things to look at, to read while we're watching the NBA playoffs this year.
Oh boy. Okay. That's interesting. So I think that there are different levels. One, the books written by the Free Darko Collective, back in the kind of mid-2000s, are excellent sort of introductory guides. They have one, the Free Darko's, Undisputed Guide to Pro Basketball History. That's an excellent, excellent kind of book, I think, that takes you through basketball history, through NBA history, and can give you some perspective on what's going on right now. And sort of, I think, guides... it does a useful job of talking about style as an important part of the game, and of the culture of the game. And it can kind of get with which they can see what's going on the court in a slightly different light during the playoffs.
Well, I thank you
for... That's off the top of my head. I'd probably come up with more if I were asked. And obviously, Ball Don't Lie.
And Ball Don't Lie. Well, I enjoyed Ball Don't Lie immensely, and I think obviously other people's do as well. And thank you, Professor Kolas, for taking the time to speak with me today.
Oh, thanks for having me, John. It was really fun. I really enjoyed talking with thoughtful readers, so I appreciate it.
Oh, well, thank you very much. That's it for this edition of the Passport Play Podcast. Subscribe to the podcast on iTunes or by visiting passportplay.tumblr.com.